It was the scream that was heard around the world.
And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House! Yeah!
That is Howard Dean from 10 years ago this month delivering an impassioned speech after placing third in the Iowa caucus. Pundits and late-night hosts called it a crazy red-faced rant. Didn't matter that he was hoarse and speaking in a very noisy room. The isolated audio of the so-called Dean scream helped destroy his fledgling candidacy. More recently, Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman came under fire for his exuberant remarks with a reporter after winning the NFC Championship. New York Congressman Michael Grimm picked up the rage mantle for threatening to throw a New York One reporter off a balcony just last week. Our aversion to passionate outbursts is not unprecedented. According to William Harris, director of Columbia University's Center for the Ancient Mediterranean, even Homer and Plato were preoccupied with emotional control. Harris is author of the book Mental Disorders and the Classical World and is currently researching mental disorders in the times of the Greeks and the Romans. William Harris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
So what would Stoics have thought of Howard Dean or Richard Sherman?
They would have been very disapproving, no question about that. In general, Stoics would have thought that that was a serious moral failing, and displays of anger in particular were to be avoided by all sensible human beings.
That's so interesting to me because I think of classical antiquity and projecting strength and great impassioned oratory. Did they see a distinction between strength and rage?
Oh, yes. And rage is a particular problem. As you said, it starts very early on with Homer, and it goes on all the way through classical antiquity. And one of the reasons why I studied this phenomenon was because it's so much an obsession of theirs. And partly that's to do with the whole business of constructing a city-state and how people are going to behave. So, you know, it's all very well for people to argue about politics and to scream a little bit like Howard Dean, but people have to observe limits in the way that they are going to display their anger. Otherwise, eventually you end up with civil war. And another problem is to do with slavery, because much as we may admire the Greeks and Romans, we have to face the fact that they all lived in slave societies. Some were more dependent on slavery than others, but all of them had slaves. And the situation of slaveholder versus slave is one which is full of potential anger, fairly obviously. And if you're going to manage it in a slave society, you need to be able to control the anger of the slaves, but you need also to be able to control your own anger, because if you lose your temper with your slaves too much, well, they bide their time and they get their revenge. And this is a Greek and Roman idea which gave rise to lots of practical thinking about how to control anger.
That is fascinating. So they were sort of modeling moderation from the top so that there wouldn't be unrest among the plebs. I mean, this sounds like it's coming from very top down. Any indication of how emotional extremes were regarded among the citizens?
Oh, yes. And not only among citizens, but among slaves. And you're perfectly right that the writings that we're talking about are top down. So emotional control as an ideal spread down to a lot of the rest of the population. But at the same time, of course, ordinary people could get very angry, whether we're talking about classical Athens or classical Rome, late Republican Rome, and people had lots of grievances and could get very angry about them. And you might say that without that anger, there would never have been very much reform. So there is a social divide, as you're hinting.
Did the ideal of emotional control, was that focused on rage, or was it any kind of passionate extreme?
Oh, as far as the Stoics are concerned, it's any kind of passion, any kind of pathos. That's their word for it. So the ideal Stoic would have been a very cold fish, in fact, because he or she would not have approved of, let's say, ardent expressions of love either, or in any other emotion. So the Stoics were aware of the fact that practically no human being could ever become an ideal Stoic, though. And they knew that the wise man, that's their ideal person, is a pretty rare creature.
Well, I know you've spent a lot of time studying this, and I did a very sort of peripheral read of what you do, but they sound to me like control freaks, obviously, but it wasn't just like a sort of, I don't know, neuroses. Rage was actually considered an illness at that time. How did the ancients treat that? Did they see it as something that could be corrected or fixed?
They saw it as something that could be corrected, but as far as rage is concerned, for example, they were very heavily dependent on self-control. And the most interesting ancient authority on this subject is the 2nd century AD physician Galen, who has left us a huge amount of writing, including a treatise in which he explains as well as he can how you control rage. And essentially, you need to be continuously vigilant. And if you feel that rage is coming on, you need to try to exercise control. And you don't make any exceptions for yourself. And you have to get into training. Obviously, this kind of thing only helps with rather mild kinds of mental disorders. It doesn't help with, you know, extreme schizophrenia or anything of that kind. But there's some good advice in Galen, I think, and to some extent in other ancient writers as well.
We're speaking with William Harris, professor of history at Columbia University, and also a researcher who's done a lot of work looking at mental disorders in the classical world. I'm curious about your research into this because the language is completely different. The regard for, you know, the sort of ciphers and the prophets and the people who spoke out of turn is completely different. How do you find evidence of mental disorders in the ancient world?
Oh, it's all over the place. And it's there already in Homer. And one of the reasons why I studied this phenomenon is because the Greeks and Romans talk about it so much. Greeks in particular. Already in book 20 of the Odyssey, there is a bizarre scene of hallucination, rather complicated one to explain, but this is obviously a phenomenon that Homer is very interested in, and it goes on all the way through antiquity. So this is a big feature of their culture, and starting in the 5th century BC with the Hippocratic doctors, there's a really epoch-making change that comes about because some Greeks start trying to give rational explanations of mental disorders without reference to the gods. And prior to that, Greeks, like many other early peoples, tended to attribute mental disorders to divine intervention of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the ancient world, lots of people continued to do that. It's enough to read the New Testament to see that. But at the same time, there are doctors and philosophers who are trying to explain things in what we could call, just to summarize it, a more rational fashion.
Well, Professor Harris, is that something that we might describe today as schizophrenia? I mean, can we apply our contemporary paradigms of mental illness to those displays?
Well, only with tremendous caution, I think. I've fairly frequently, during this research, been to encounters of various kinds with psychiatrists, and I'm trying to keep up to date with, as far as it's possible for an outsider to do so, with the literature in that field. And as I'm sure that many of your listeners know, the categories that we use nowadays for mental disorders are very much under discussion and under dispute. We haven't, let's say, mastered this field altogether. And so to apply diagnosis in modern terms to somebody who lived in antiquity is a very tricky business. And whenever, you know, I read in books that the Emperor Caligula was a schizophrenic or something of that kind, I want to put on the brakes. It's true that our categories are probably better than the categories which the Greeks and Romans used, but they are still very problematic.
Do you ever wonder, as an historian who's looking back through thousands of years, how historians of the future will look back at our contemporary society and describe our mental illness and treatment?
Well, I hope, in a sense, that they will be able to look back and think that psychiatry and the study of mental disorders was still, in 2014, at a pretty early stage of its development, and that they will be a bit complacent about the fact that they've learned a lot more. I'm not necessarily predicting that this will happen, but that's what I would hope will happen. And, of course, you know, in our own lifetimes, we've seen very important developments in psychiatric diagnosis. The most obvious and most famous one is that in an earlier edition of the DSM, if we go back the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, if we go back 40 years, homosexual desire was regarded as a serious disorder, and there was a lot about that. And in the recent editions, more recent editions of the DSM, that of course has disappeared completely. So, you know, the real change, progress, I think, has taken place. That was only one example. There are others as well of how, the official scheme for diagnosing mental disorders has changed.
William Harris, thank you for opening up this window into the ancient world for us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
William Harris, professor of history and director of Columbia University Center for the Ancient Mediterranean. You can find out more on his research and specifically on his book, Mental Disorders in the Classical World, by going to wordofmouthradio.org.